Hey guys and gals, just wanted to remind you about that great promotion we have going on over at Naira Bets, the $200 match deposit bonus for all the new players. Just type in the promo code REWIND, that's REWIND, and come hang out with us at Belmont this weekend with great racing like the Grade 3 Bold Ruler. Don't forget the promo code REWIND, REWIND. Check it out at NairaBets.com or the Naira Bets app. Terms and conditions do apply. Welcome to episode 62 of Red Board Rewind. My name is Spencer Luganbuehl. And today, my special guest is the Naira Mooring Line Maker, David Aragona. We go over the state bred stake laden card from last Saturday at Belmont on some angles that we talk about are how a favorite can win last time out and it can be a negative, and why a class drop and switch to a top rider is still one of the best angles in the game. This is Red Board Rewind. It's the same old story. And now I'd like to welcome in my special guest for this week, David Aragona, the Mooring Line Maker for all the Naira tracks. David, how are you today?
Doing pretty well. Happy to come on and recap some races.
Very excited to have you on. Obviously, you being a Mooring Line Maker, I'm sure people all over the Twitterverse, you tend to see those, oh, what is this Mooring Line? And for me, it's almost like a job that you know you're not going to get thanks for. Have you ever had a perfect Mooring Line? I've always been curious about that. Have you ever had a race where you're just absolutely perfect in every single horse?
I think the closest I ever came was the 2018 Jim Dandy, where it was a 5-horse field, so not too hard. And I think I had 3 right on the dot, and the 2 others were like each half a point off. It's tough to get it exactly right because just the way the money comes in with scratches, it's difficult that you find a situation where the horses can all be right on the dot where you pegged them. But I've had a few situations where it's gotten very close.
I'm sure it's got to be, like we said, it's a thankless job to a lot of gamblers. They don't really understand, how somebody could be so wrong. Obviously, we hear stuff from other Mooring Line Makers. I've always said, in your estimation, just not because I'm having you on the show, but the Naira Mooring Line for me over the last, 10 years that I've been watching racing, it always seems to be one of the top Mooring Lines. When you sat down the first day of doing it, were you like, oh, this will be easy? Or then you were like, oh, this is going to be very difficult.
Well, when I first started doing this task, I had never made Mooring Lines before. And obviously, I had a lot to live up to because Eric Donovan, who did the Mooring Line at Naira before me, who's now overseeing a lot of their TV productions, he did a fantastic Mooring Line. So the month of December before I started in January of 2018, I just spent a lot of time doing practice Mooring Lines and then comparing them to how they actually bet the races afterwards. So I did about 10 practice runs before I actually started doing it officially. And it's kind of funny the way it worked out that January of 2018, you might remember, after the new year, there was this huge snowstorm in New York and they canceled like 7 or 8 consecutive race days at Aqueduct. So I did like basically 7 or 8 more practice Mooring Lines that never actually got to be tested out because they canceled all those cards. So I got a lot of practice before it actually started counting.
I'll remember I was like that month, I'm like, okay, I'm gonna start Aqueduct, I'm gonna just bet Naira all year. And I did like all the cards 2 days in advance, just like you guys would be doing. And when you cancel 4 or 5, I'm like, this is getting ridiculous. Like, can we just get some races through on Naira so I'm not just wasting my time with all these cards?
Yeah, it was pretty frustrating, but it all worked out in the end.
So, obviously, you're also a handicapper. How much different is it from when, obviously, some Mooring Line Makers aren't handicappers, so they're just doing the Mooring Line, they don't study as much as we do. How much of a difference did that make when you started making the Mooring Lines? Was it hard to kind of, guess what the public would be doing with a Chad Brown first, or compared to, like, maybe a horse in someone's barn might be doing better than the public would, but you still have to kind of focus on what the public would be doing?
I mean, I think to some extent, every handicapper has to have some idea of how they think races are going to be bet. Some rely on morning lines more heavily than others do. I know some people who are handicappers just completely turn off the morning lines of their past performances because they don't want to be influenced by somebody else's opinion. And they'll just kind of handicap the races blind and come up with their own idea of where they think the odds are going to land. So I think every handicapper that's really serious about betting has to kind of have some preconceived notion of how the public's going to bet races. So not everyone would be a great morning line maker, but they have to do a little bit of that work, I think, to get to the handicapping portion of it. And for me, I don't find it that difficult. Sometimes you do have to kind of separate the two tasks because the way the public approaches a race is not the way that I necessarily approach a race. So I do try to make the morning line first and then kind of shut off that part of my brain and then move on to the handicapping. It gets tough for me to do them both at the same time because it really is two completely separate tasks. But I find it to be helpful for me just in the long run, especially looking back on races afterwards, to kind of look at the races through somebody else's eyes, which is, I think, basically what making the morning line is, and then kind of deciding what you really want to emphasize. And doing both parts of those tasks, it has showed me over the past couple of years where I might be putting the wrong emphasis or some things that I might want to put more stock in the future, because you're forced to consider some angles that you might not have in the past.
I think that's something that's very true. My fiance, she recently just started handicapping less than a year ago, but one day she came up to me, she's like, teach me what you do. So we spent, you know, a couple hour-long sessions trying to learn. And now when we handicap races, she, of course, came up with Authentic in the Derby, which I will never hear the end of until next Kentucky Derby. But just how she kind of came among the horse and how I had kind of, you know, said the horse has no chance. It's just having someone who's almost the beginner type still and learning the angles but wanting to study, it kind of makes you remember what you tend to forget and push aside when you were beginning. And it's hard to kind of juggle all those balls in the air at one point where it's like course for course, distance specialists, you know, the class drops, the class jumps. It's just having that extra person next to you and having that group of friends always seems to help when it comes to handicapping.
Yeah, it's funny. I was talking to somebody recently who's a little bit of a novice handicapping, and we were going to go for a race at Belmont last week. People might remember it was the race that Control Group wired a claiming field for Orlando Noda. And I was making this case about why the horse was vulnerable, had a claim voided last time, had been a drop down two back, all these reasons that maybe the horse is going to regress as the favorite in this situation. And he was just like, but the horse is the lone speed, and he's faster than everybody else by a significant margin. So, and sometimes you just have to go back to basics like that and really emphasize the stuff that's so important. And obviously the horse just galloped on the lead.
Obviously you also work with time form, going over a lot of pace stuff. Is that pretty much where your top type of pillar of handicapping? Obviously form, speed, figures, class, and pace. Is pace kind of like where you always start off when you start off a race handicapping?
Yeah, I mean, I start off usually with the speed figures just to kind of sort the contenders into different groups and see who really is fast enough to win this specific race. And then, yeah, you do have to take pace into account. I obviously use the Timeform US tools, the pace ratings that they actually print in the daily race, all the daily racing form PPs now, as well as the pace projector to just kind of get a sense of how the race is going to unfold. I mean, I don't always look at the pace projector and say, okay, this is exactly how the race has to be run. But it just gives you a sense of who the fastest horses actually are. And then you can basically build off that to make your own determination of how you think the different riders are going to react to that situation, how you think maybe there's a reason that you disagree with the pace projector. And it just gets you thinking about pace a little bit more, whereas sometimes people might overlook that a little bit.
I'm definitely more of a buyer and class guy compared to pace. I just don't think I have a good enough understanding of pace yet, and just it's the one crutch I'm really trying to strengthen in the years to come. I love the fact that you do use the buyers first, because I get a lot of argument of people who go, well, if the horse is low in speed, he should obviously win the race. And I'm like, well, he's 20 buyer points short, and he's had the lone lead the last three races. So I'm like, tell me how the picture will be different this time out.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in speed figures. I don't really understand this kind of sentiment out there that speed figures are just these made up numbers that don't matter. To me, time and again, it's proven that speed figures really do matter. It's not somebody just coming up with a number that they believe. That's not what a speed figure's job is. It's a mathematical equation or algorithm that's basically figuring out how fast the horse actually ran based on the relative to other races that were run that day or that meet. And there is some subjectivity to it a little bit. Sometimes you don't have enough data to come up with a number that you're really confident in. But by and large, most of the time, speed figures are really based on math. They're not based on someone's opinion. So I don't really understand why people would not put stock in speed figures.
For me, when Timeform jumped into the DRF, I had used Timeform here and there and again, and I liked it. It was interesting. When they finally moved to the DRF and I could see the blue and the red pace figures, and I could start making the ability figures of this horse was alone on the lead and won by 9 and ran a 90, where it was more of like maybe an 80 to an 85 buyer. How important do you think that is when obviously we have, you know, Stats Race Lens, Formulator, the Timeform, now that that's mixed together? How important is it when we start to mix together that certain stuff and kind of make it become a family of, you know, handicapping products?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there are so many tools out there. I primarily use the Daily Racing Form Classic, the Formulator PPs, and Timeform US PPs. I would say that I put about equal weight in each of them when I'm handicapping, including the speed figures, the Timeform US speed figures, as well as the buyers. I think they're just really complementary to each other because the buyer, obviously, is just a final time-based rating. Mm-hmm. So it's not really taking into account how fast the pace was. And the Timeform US speed figure does take into account how fast the pace was and will adjust that final time number up or down based on whether or not the horse was with or against the pace of that race. So if a horse went out and set an extremely fast pace and just kind of dropped off at the end, they're going to get a boost in the Timeform US speed figure, whereas a horse that might have gone out and set a slow pace and then accelerated in the end and run a faster final time, in most cases they're going to get their final time speed figure knocked down because they were with the race flow.
We've kind of talked about your process. Kind of give me some angles now that you love, either that you started off like when you were first learning or some that you have, you know, come to in the recent past that you just love to see, second time blinkers, first time Lasix, etc.
I mean, I wouldn't say that I'm somebody who relies heavily on specific angles. I do pay a lot of attention to trainer stats, so there are certain trainers' specific statistics that I will pay attention to. I mean, there are some that people know really well, like Linda Rice always does fantastic with second-time starters, but there are some other trainer stats that are a little more hidden, not too well-known. Like, people don't always realize that Bill Mott does extremely well with first-time starters that are three-year-olds and older. Not so well with the two-year-olds, but consistently over the past several years, he just has a fantastic percentage and ROI with first-time starters, and it feels like so often people paint him as a trainer that doesn't win first time out, and actually the opposite is true. So I like to find trainer stats like that that I can really emphasize. And also, I'm really started out as a trip handicapper, and I do use that still quite a bit, but it feels like trip handicapping has become so prevalent these days that it's harder than it was to find value with horses that had bad trips. So I try to emphasize some other things more in the past few years.
Well, it's even like, and I'll bring up an example. I was looking through races and I had handicapped a little bit. I literally just circled Mr. Buff in the big stake race later on in the card. And I said, okay, he'll be 2-5. And then I watched a couple of the early races, had to run out, didn't watch the end. And I was talking with Marshall Sterling. He goes, yeah, Mr. Buff paid 940. I'm like, excuse me? How much did this horse pay? And it's something where, you know, trip handicapping, but this horse had such good buyers in the state bred ranks that for him to pay that type of price, it felt like to me, like just people weren't, you know, they were looking more at trips and class and not looking again at speed figures like that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Mr. Buff. He's just a really cool horse to watch run. And I was kind of scratching my head after the race how he could have paid $9. I picked a long shot in that race just taking a shot against somebody else because I figured the two favorites would be pretty close in mm-hmm. price. They really went for one and just ignored Mr. Buff. I mean, he was almost the third choice in the race, I think, behind Seafoam. It just didn't make a whole lot of sense. Obviously, Mr. Buff had those back speed figures that just towered over the field, including towering over the best speed figures of Funny Guy. And the real question with Mr. Buff was, could he rebound from those poor graded stakes attempts over the summer? And I mean, if you were a supporter of Mr. Buff, you could have said, well, he's run poorly in graded stakes in the past and bounced back against New York Breds, and he did the same thing on Saturday.
I think it's kind of like that same angle where, you know, you're just jumping back into the pool with your friends in a way. The state bred ranks, you know, they are different than the open company. And people always ask, you know, when I work at the bet squad for Saratoga, you know, why is this race, you know, why does it seem like the buyers are so much lower? And it's not that they're lower, it's just the competition, you know, you're facing just horses within New York or bred within New York compared to the horses shipping in from Florida, Kentucky, you know, out west. And I think that that's a key thing now is the state bred programs are getting so much better. I'm starting to feel like the New York program is going to be, you know, at least maybe top two or three in the country right now.
Yeah, Mr. Buff is still kind of a funny horse because I was pretty convinced that he improved so much over the winter that I thought he was just going to be really competitive in a race like the Suburban, where the only other horse that he really had to deal with that was on his level was Tacitus. And for whatever reason, he just couldn't hang with those graded stakes horses. His speed figures really drop off when he gets into those graded stakes races, and they jump right back up when he goes to the New York Breds. Most horses, regardless of class, their speed figures are usually more consistent than that, especially when they're on the level of Mr. Buff. So he is kind of a conundrum in that sense, but consistently over the past few years, it's just worked out that way.
One question, this is more from my point of view, growing up watching Naira my entire life. You know, I live right in upstate New York. Watching you come on, first time ever talking horses with Andy Serling, have you watched Naira for most of your life, or was it kind of just a new thing for you? How was it being on the desk for the first time with Andy?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I had followed the Naira circuit heavily since I was a little kid. So, I mean, I just would watch all of their productions religiously from when I was, you know, in the 90s watching Harvey Pack and John and Brial do Talking Horses. So, yeah, it was really cool for me. I mean, I had gotten to know Andy a little bit before we actually did the first show together. And I had never done anything on camera before, nothing like that. So I was pretty nervous. But once I got into it, I realized that talking about horse racing is something that I've done for years, and it's really easy to just basically sit down with a friend and put out your opinions about horse races. And after a while, you just kind of forget the camera's there. It just feels like a conversation with a friend.
I kind of feel the same way. I have had Andy on the show twice. I recently just had Barry Meadow, who to me is one of the top four on Mount Rushmore for me for horse racing in general and just the handicapping book genre. And I feel like doing these podcasts, this is the 62nd one I've done so far. The first few I can just go back and listen to, and I'm like, wow, I sounded just so nervous and just so complacent. And now having done so many, you just kind of realize that you're just sitting across the table at someone like at a bar and you're just talking racing.
Yeah, exactly. We all have this one thing in common and we all speak the same language, and it just makes it easier to converse and not really worry about the fact that other people are watching, because those people that are watching are the same people that you'd want to talk to about with horse racing.
Why don't you say we get started with these races, three races today, races 4, 6, and 9. The first race is race number 4. It was the state bred 150,000 Ticonderoga going 1 1/16 miles on the inner turf. What were your thoughts going to this race, David?
So my thoughts going into this race were, my heart belongs to Daddy, who's going to be the favorite, had gotten two incredibly soft trips up at Saratoga. One was in a race where there just didn't appear to be any speed last time out in the Yaddo, and her rider sent her to the front. It seemed like everybody knew she was going to go to the front because she was bet down to 3-2 that day, despite not really stacking up from a class perspective. And then her race before that, it seemed like there was some speed on paper, but there was a traffic jam at the start. The other speeds couldn't show the speed that they would have been expected to come out with, and she got to the front end of wire to field in a slow pace. So my take on it was, okay, she's coming off two races where she was incredibly fortunate, setting slow paces. Yes, she's improved quite a bit since we saw her in Chad Brown's barn last year. But still, she had gotten so lucky in those two races that the fact that Short Pour was in this race, and Short Pour was actually one of those horses that was so badly compromised at the start when My Heart Belongs to Daddy wired that field on July 30th, that Short Pour had to show more speed in this race, because just based on pace figures and the fractions they had run, she's a faster horse than My Heart Belongs to Daddy. So I thought it would be a different situation for My Heart Belongs to Daddy, and I was going to hold out hope that War Canoe and We Gets to Monies, if given at least a fair pace scenario, were just superior horses.
For me, this race was super interesting. It kind of came down to like a story of Chad Brown. Obviously, My Heart Belongs to Daddy, races three back, we're still in Chad's barn. And I would love to see a statistic on how many trainers can actually improve a horse once out of Chad Brown's barn. I always looked at Jorge Abreu, 12% on the turf is kind of just that average turf trainer. And for this horse, like you said, though, to get the two soft trips. And this is where the pace thing for me kind of comes into a different limelight where, oh, this horse got two soft trips. Well, there's also a chance, because this horse loves to go to lead, that they can just keep getting soft trip after soft trip after soft trip as well, no?
Yeah, there is that old adage, good horses make their own good trips. And I think that's true to an extent. Horses that have tactical speed do have the option to get into a forward position when it's most going to benefit them in races without that other speed. And when it races with a lot of speed, they have that also that option to get out and see what their options are and take back if necessary. And obviously, My Heart Belongs to Daddy has all those options at her disposal. But that said, I think this race was a situation where one other rider made a decision not to go to the front that affected the entire outcome of the race.
I think two other horses that were interesting, obviously, on the inside, War Canoe, Chad Brown, Irad. Obviously, we know what these connections can do. I just thought it was interesting that after having claimed this horse for the 62 four back, had three chances in races, the first race being the Mount Vernon with a soft pace with those blue fractions. I think it's very rare to have Chad have a horse in the barn for three starts and not have a winner yet.
Yeah, it is a little weird. I mean, he's runner, obviously, in three, now four straight stakes races. So it's not like he's been trying to put her in easier spots. But still, she's gotten a bit of a reputation as a horse that just doesn't want to win anymore. I don't know that I totally buy that, because in the past, for other barns like Linda Rice and even for Gary Contessa before that, I mean, she was a horse that loved to win races. Mm-hmm. So I think, and I actually picked her in this Ticonderoga, thinking that she was a horse that in her three starts for Chad Brown had just been a little bit unlucky. Not so much the Mount Vernon, but especially in the last two starts, the Day at the Spa and the Yaddo. Irad Ortiz, arguably the best turf rider in the country. You really don't have to go through his merits. I mean, it's just generally accepted that he's one of the top riders in the country. I do not think he's ridden this horse very well. He didn't save any ground in those two races at Saratoga, had her farther off slow paces than he really should have, because she does have more tactical speed than that. And I thought he'd correct those errors in the Ticonderoga. That's not how the race played out.
We get to monies for me. Just, I thought the horse was in racer sharp form. Obviously, Christophe Clement, even going back to Saratoga, has been very, very good this year. I'm always nervous, and I feel like a lot of beginner handicappers do look at this, and maybe not the veterans don't. The career box. 0-for-6 at the distance, but 2 seconds, 2/3. This one just seems maybe that the distance might be a little bit too far and just loves to get pieces. What are your thoughts when looking at the career box? Do you focus a lot on that horse for course, distance specialist, you know, what they've done the last few years? Or is it more of just, you know, just kind of look at the page and focus more on that?
She's a really funny horse, because her career, I mean, she's just basically transformed from the beginning of her career until mm-hmm. now. She actually started out as a dirt sprinter, and there were early in her career when she was racing a mile on the 16th, there were concerns that that was way too far for her because she had excelled going shorter. And now when she's a 5-year-old mare in Christophe Clement's barn, we're wondering if a mile on the 16th is too short for her because he's tried her marathon races. She's won a couple of races going a mile and an eighth. So she's just a funny horse that's really changed over time. I don't know what it is, if it's just kind of fluky, because she actually has earned her best career buyer going a mile on the 16th. And I think it's really important to look at that. The career box is something, in terms of their record, their career tally, is something that I put very little stock in, because it's really dependent on where the horse ran in those races and who they're running against. I really try to pay more attention to what were the buyers that they ran, or just the speed figures that you're using. What were the speed figures in those races that they ran at that distance? And We Gets to Monies has run some of her best races going a mile on the 16th. So I didn't really view the distance as a big negative.
Something I love to do as well when I'm looking at a race is We Gets to Money. I just thought that maybe this horse would just keep running in that mid to high 80 buyer. And so I would kind of mark that. I'm like, okay, this is where this horse's plateau is. Can someone improve and be better? Or is this a horse that, like, if that mid 80 and we can get a decent price, you might be able to want to hit the board. Are you one that kind of puts stock into that, where you'll kind of try and guess where the buyer will be before the race happens?
I mean, a little bit. With a horse like her, she's just so consistent. She's typically running those same figures, as you noted. So I think you could reasonably expect her to do the same thing. And she's a 5-year-old mare now who, it's not like she's coming off a layoff. She's been running all summer. So I wouldn't really have projected her to improve a lot. And there was the chance that she wouldn't have to improve much on her last race. She would just have to turn the tables on My Heart Belongs to Daddy, getting a better pace setup, because she did not get a good setup last time in the Yaddo.
What did you end up doing from a wagering perspective if you were betting this race, David?
This was not a race that I really looked at as one that I wanted to bet a horse to win or anything like that. I did play this race through some multi-race wagers, and I basically ended up using War Canoe on equal strength with My Heart Belongs to Daddy. I wasn't so against My Heart Belongs to Daddy where I wanted to take a big stand against her, because, as we said, she's the horse with tactical speed in a race where the two other contenders were closers. I just thought she didn't deserve to be the kind of massive favorite that she was likely to go off at, and I was hoping that War Canoe, who I made my top pick in this race, I was just hoping that War Canoe would be more involved early in the race because she does have that tactical speed. And also, I just thought that she was compromised by pace and trip in her last couple of starts, and maybe she'd get the right setup in here.
Even with the soft trips for My Heart Belongs to Daddy, this is a horse that I thought was just a very strong favorite. Maybe not so much even money, but just one that at even money I thought was worth a win wager. I know sometimes when we talk about getting those lower ranges, you have to be so right 4 out of 5, you know, 8 out of 10 times to be profitable. I thought this was going to be one of those spots, so I took a chance with a nice big win bet on My Heart Belongs to Daddy. Let's see who wins the fourth here right now.
And they're off. War Canoe away well from the rail. Short Pour now moves up along with My Heart Belongs to Daddy. And it is My Heart Belongs to Daddy who goes on with it to take the lead over Short Pour. Nico's Dream has moved up on the outside into third, a length and a half, to We Gets the Monies, who's in between horses. War Canoe is down at the rail and now back running in fifth, and Longshot Pecatonica is the trailer. The field moves up the backstretch. My Heart Belongs to Daddy, the even money favorite, leads here by a length after a quarter in 25 seconds. Nico's Dream and Short Pour, they are right together second and third. The gray, We Gets the Monies, is in fourth. Pecatonica's on the outside, and now War Canoe is the trailer in sixth. It is My Heart Belongs to Daddy in front here by a length and a quarter now. Short Pour and Nico's Dream remain together second and third. The half went in 51 seconds. We Gets the Monies in fourth, three lengths from the front. Then Pecatonica and War Canoe. They begin the run into the far turn. My Heart Belongs to Daddy, the leader here by a half length. Short Pour in second by a half length. On the outside is Nico's Dream. Then We Gets the Monies, followed by Pecatonica and War Canoe, who's down towards the inside and trailing. Three quarters in 14 and 2. They're at the top of the stretch. My Heart Belongs to Daddy is the one to catch. She's got the lead here in the stretch, and she's in front by 2.5 lengths. She's drifting out a bit here in the stretch. My Heart Belongs to Daddy out in the middle of the course now. Nico's Dream runs in second. My Heart Belongs to Daddy is in front despite drifting out, and she is going to take the Ticonderoga. My Heart Belongs to Daddy continues to the roll in 2020.
And the number four, My Heart Belongs to Daddy, does win paying 420 with a 91 buyer. So just a small improvement for her. And also War Canoe running second again. I know a lot of people on Twitter were like, see, she doesn't like to win. Well, I mean, I think she made a heck of a run from in the back of the pack.
Yeah. Watching this race, I basically said to myself, okay, well, in the first quarter mile, this is over. I was wrong. I'm not going to win this bet. I'm not going to get the horse that I wanted to get home on top, War Canoe, who was the much better price than My Heart Belongs to Daddy, because my whole theory of the race was that Short Pour, who had in sprint races won fractions of 22 and 45 in the past, the not so distant past, she was just faster than My Heart Belongs to Daddy, and she was going to force that one into a stalking position. Well, you saw that came out of the gate from that kind of funky start going a mile and 16th of the inner course, and Short Pour maybe broke a neck behind My Heart Belongs to Daddy, but it was very clear that Joel Rosario, who was riding Short Pour, wanted no part of the early lead for whatever reason. I don't know if that was the plan or the trainer's instructions. I kind of doubt that, or if he just decided to do that. But it allowed My Heart Belongs to Daddy to get to the front in another extremely slow pace. And we saw in the Yaddo that the two horses who were her main rivals couldn't beat her in that situation last time, and they couldn't beat her in that same scenario again.
How frustrating is it when you're trying to figure out pace and now Naira's known as the clutch and grab group of riders and we see 25 and 51? I mean, it's got to just be frustrating when the old adage for turf is, you know, pick the best class and late kick horse. Even the best late kick is not going to get it done when they're going 51 to the half.
Well, that's totally true. It's not. And a lot of races are very frustrating to watch. Personally, I'm not a fan of any of the races going a mile and 16th on the inner trip course, because I think you see that at its worst in those races. Mm-hmm. When all of the riders are a little tentative coming out of the gate. There's really not even a temporary rail there. There's just kind of a wire on the inside. So you've got to make sure your horse is running straight and not running to open space. You kind of have to go up a hill and then down again because you're coming over the Widener turf course to get onto the inner turf course. So I just don't like that start because I think it creates a situation where a lot of riders instinctively want to grab their horses. And I mean, with regard to Short Poor not showing speed in this race, I know Mark Hennig's not a guy that likes to see his horses rated a whole lot. I would say that if you want your horse to show speed in a race, probably don't name Joel Rosario on that horse because he's just a guy that doesn't tend to show a lot of speed. And I say that as a huge fan of Joel Rosario. I think he's one of the best turf riders in the country and is great in so many situations, one of the best finishers in horse racing. But he doesn't typically show a lot of speed unless there is no other speed in the race or he has specific instructions to get very aggressive. I guess I shouldn't have been totally surprised when Short Poor didn't show that kind of speed. But that's just the way, as you said, we see a lot of races play out that way. And that's how this one played out. And I'll just add with War Canoe, I thought Irad Ortiz could have done a little more to help her, and instead he just took her to the back of the pack, really not even with that second flight of runners, just behind the entire field. And I don't know what the plan is in that situation because you can't be riding to win. These riders do have clocks in their heads, and there was no way for her to win from that situation. She put in a good late run. Perhaps she was just second best overall at the end of the day anyway, but she just had no shot from her early position.
For me, it seems like War Canoe is one that we should be looking for on the bet back, especially with Chad Brown being the trainer. If we can get 5-2 on a horse like this consistently, maybe a win is not so far away in the near distant future.
Well, maybe we'll see again at Aqueduct. Linda Rice ran her in that optional claiming 62,000 last year on the turf there, and she got the job done. Seems like a horse now. It's a 7-year-old. Maybe she is worth putting in for that claiming tag in the future. So maybe Chad Brown will get a little creative and put her in that kind of spot at Aqueduct.
Let's jump to our next race, race number 6. It was another state bred 175 Emperor Distaff going 1/116 miles on the dirt this time. Radzikowski, winner of this last year. What were your thoughts going into this race, David?
My thoughts were she's a horse that I think I want to take a shot against at a relatively short price. But the question is, who do I want to take a shot against her with? Because I thought you could make a case for just about every horse in this entire field. Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe Forever Change was a little tough to make, but there were things to like about the other 5 horses that were drawn outside of Radzikowski in this field. So for me, it was just trying to determine who do I think is the most reliable option to cause this upset, because I just knew I didn't want to totally pitch Radzikowski. I knew that she could win this race. I just thought she'd be an underlay. So I wanted to find somebody to use against her.
I think, too, when you look at this type of horse and the last race being at Saratoga and the buyers dropping off considerably down to a 70, I know she was off a step slow, but maybe this is just one that after so many wins and hitting the board, maybe she is going to go off form a little bit. Like you just said, everyone to the outside seemed to be really good. Some horses that I had liked, Critical Value, Jeremiah, I just didn't know if maybe that Fleet Indian was just, mile and eighth might just be too far. So when they cut, I thought the cutback was good. I thought the 81 last time out running third in the N1X allowance was decent, and I just thought this is one that might be able to improve third time off the layoff. And also, Mrs. Orb, as people know on this podcast, I am not the biggest Dylan Davis fan. I need to start becoming one, I believe. Just had that nice run of form, winning 4 straight with Dylan, and then off the layoff in the Critical Eye and Union Ave, running second, just missing both times to Radzikowski and Newly Minted. Michael Maselli also very good off the layoff and going sprint to route. I thought this one could be very dangerous from the outside.
Yeah, so my take on Radzikowski was that let's look at her last race in the context of her entire career, her last race being that disappointing loss as the even money favorite of the Union Avenue. She is a 6-year-old mare, a very big horse who must have had some physical setbacks along the way because she didn't make her debut until May of her 5-year-old season. So she's definitely a horse that maybe from the get-go might not be totally reliable to always hold her form. And she had a really good run of success in 2019. She ascended to the stakes level very quickly and was in great form coming into this race last year. Her return this year in the Critical Eye, her first start for Grand Motion, it was good. taking into account the pace of that race, she did run better than Mrs. Orb that day, even though the margin of victory was just a neck. Her last race, though, in the Union Avenue, that was not good. Maybe you could say 7 furlongs is a little bit short for her, but she was sluggish away from the gate. But even after that, I mean, I wouldn't use the start as the entire excuse for her because she got up into a 3-wide stalking position. It's not like she was ranking behind horses. She had her chance to win that race and just couldn't really accelerate in the stretch. Furthermore, that was a slow race. Nobody really showed up. She was supposed to win it. And I never like to put too much stock in trainer quotes because I often think that they're not really based on anything that you should put a lot of stock in. It's just kind of building a narrative around a horse, but they have their own reasons for doing that. But Graham Motion is the kind of guy that I think is generally pretty honest. And he said, I have no excuse for her last race. I'm just hoping that we can throw it out. And I never like to hear that. Especially from a guy like Graham Motion. I just kind of wondered if maybe she's heading in the wrong direction. So I knew I wanted to be against her. And I, too, was considering Critical Value. I was also considering Mrs. Orb and Lucky Move. I thought they were the three most likely upsetters. I ultimately decided that Critical Value, even a mile and 16th, is just pushing her stamina to the limit. I really think she's a horse that doesn't want to go much farther than 7 furlongs. She's got a nice turn of foot going shorter, but going longer distances, she just gets there and can't finish off her races. I mean, she couldn't get the mile and 1/8 to the point that she was basically eased to back in that Fleet Indian that you mentioned. So I was just kind of concerned about her going the distance. Lucky Move, I mean, from a speed figure standpoint, she was the horse that you probably wanted because she had those superior speed figures coming in, earned all against tougher open company fields. The problem that I had with her is that it seemed like her speed figures had dropped off in her one-turn races in the past, especially if that's Wintered Aqueduct. Now, maybe you can make some excuses for those races in retrospect, but I was a little concerned about the one turn for her because obviously the mile and 16th was okay. She had won that distance before. And Mrs. Orb, I've never been her biggest fan. I know that she's kind of got that speed figure ceiling around the 80 buyer, and maybe that wasn't going to be good enough. But to me, Mrs. Orb was just the most reliable horse. She was obviously coming into the race in good form. I thought the distance was right for her, and she was likely to get a good trip in a mid-pack position. So I kind of tentatively landed on her as my pick and used the other three underneath.
I think with Lucky Move, for me, I think it was just more of a oversight and just not quick handicapping, but just not noticing some key components within the form and just on paper that this horse, maybe instead of being on the decline and, you know, looking for a spot to win, was more of a shrewd spot by the claimer or by the trainer, not claimer. And just a spot that this horse could win and that it would be very interesting going forward. Like I said, I ended up on Critical Value. I just thought this horse would be improving maybe third time off the layoff. And I just did a proper win bet. Let's see who wins the sixth race. Right now.
Forever Changed came away slow and is at the back of the pack. Singular Sensation is out for the lead. Making Sense now moving up with Radikowski down at the rail. Making Sense and Radikowski. Radikowski to poke ahead in front of Making Sense. And Singular Sensation is now back running in third. Mrs. Orb is on the outside. Forever Changed advances at the rail after that slow beginning. Critical Value runs in sixth. And Lucky Move is the trailer in seventh. The quarter, 22. And 4/5 seconds. And Radikowski, the favorite here, leads by a length and a half. Making Sense running in second. And Forever Changed is next in third. On the outside is Mrs. Orb in fourth, followed by Singular Sensation. And then it's Critical Value in the purple cap and a Lucky Move. Radikowski ran the opening half in 46 2/5 seconds. And she will take the field into the far turn. Radikowski by a length and a quarter. Making Sense remains in second. Forever Changed, down at the rail. Mrs. Orb is alongside. Now Lucky Move makes a move on the extreme outside. Lucky Move is gaining ground and moving up and passing several horses. Radikowski, Making Sense. Here's Lucky Move on the extreme outside. Mrs. Orb's in between horses. And farther back is Singular Sensation. Three quarters went in 1:11 and 1. And it is Lucky Move on the outside. Making Sense continues to battle on. Radikowski is now back running in third. And then Mrs. Orb and Singular Sensation. Lucky Move with the lead. Mrs. Orb driving up on the outside. It is Lucky Move in front. Mrs. Orb in second. Lucky Move is the winner of the Empire Distaff. Mrs. Orb was second. Photo for third between Making Sense and Radikowski.
And the number six, Lucky Move, gets it done off the drop, paying $10.40 with an 83 buyer. I think it's a great win price on a horse that probably got all the value in the world here.
Yeah, as soon as the race was over, I kind of was kicking myself a little bit for not upgrading this horse more and not picking both her and Mrs. Orb over Radichkowski, because I was kind of against the favorite in this race, and I put too much stock in one angle, being the one turn versus two turn thing with Lucky Move. Mm-hmm. And in retrospect, there were so many other things pointing to her: the fact that there could have been a pace in this race, the fact that she actually does like the distance, and the fact that those two one turn races that I was putting so much stock in, and the reason that I was saying that she wasn't good enough around one turn, were both at Aqueduct over the winter, going a mile. In one of them, I kind of forgotten on February 14th. She actually blew the start that day, so she could have been closer with a better trip. And then her next race in February 28th, when she was going the one turn, the last time that she went one turn, well, that race was followed by a four-month layoff. So maybe something happened in that race to cause her to be off for so long. So there are reasons to think that maybe she wasn't at her best when she was going the one turn over the winter, and her recent form was much stronger. She was coming in with the best speed figures in the race. So there were a lot of things to like about her, and at 4-1, it was kind of a no-brainer to upgrade her. And Mrs. Orb, my pick, I thought she ran well. She ran her typical race. She got there at the end, just couldn't quite hold off Lucky Move. Basically gave me everything that I wanted out of her. She just ran into a horse that was a little better.
I think you made some great talks about Lucky Move, obviously, and this is what I now, looking back on the race, 3-for-6 at the distance, seems to be more of a distance specialist with 3 of the 5 lifetime wins coming at the distance, and just noticing small things. Irad jumping on for Vargas, who we all know that, I'm not saying Vargas is a bad rider, but it is a for sure positive jockey change. Irad probably could have ridden any horse in the race, and just noticing, oh, lost to Dunbar Road, Latruska, Nona Madeline. What would all these horses be in this race? And this horse instead kind of sneakily goes off at 4-1, and now you're kicking yourself, you know, not only this horse, but then obviously Mr. Buff later on. There's $9, $10 horses in the day of races where they could really have been bankroll builders. Mrs. Orb, I thought, ran absolutely fantastic. I always like, you know, the horse ran 74 last time out. I thought she would improve. She was really one of the only few horses to improve going up to the 80 buyer. Also, Radichkowski kind of improved back up to a 77. But when you're, you know, under 2-1 and you're the favorite, that's not something that's going to get the race done. Critical Value didn't improve like I thought. And just, I think for me, I thought was a shot in the dark, and at 5-2, probably not the right price for me to take a shot with.
Yeah, the thing with Lucky Move is, and the reason I was kind of upset with myself afterwards is, I do think a lot of people put too much stock in one turn versus two turn, and saying that horses are, or labeling horses, I should say, as two turn horses or just one turn horses. And often it's really just quite circumstantial. And going a mile and 16th at Belmont, it's a unique situation. Most racetracks can't run that kind of one-turn configuration going a mile and 16th. And you do get paces that really do heat up on that long run down the backstretch. Horses just want to run to that open space, and they can really build up quite a head of steam coming into that far turn. And that's exactly what we saw in this Empire Distaff, because, again, Radichkowski didn't break that well. She was a little flat-footed from the start, and Jose Ortiz really rode her out of the starting gate, was intent on getting her to the front end. And that scenario just really heated up the pace on the backstretch, and it created a situation where Lucky Move could make that big sweeping run from the back of the pack.
Any horse that you think needs maybe blinkers on, or maybe a distance change, or just one that you thought with a better trip next time out could be a contender?
I would like to see Critical Value turn back in distance. I really think that those elongated sprint distances are where her future lies, so I'd pay attention to that in the future. And one other horse that kind of ran a weird race in here is Singular Sensation. She actually broke on top, and then when Radichkowski was aggressively handled coming out of the starting gate, Jose Lascano basically dropped his hands and let her drop all the way back through the pack to the point where I think she was actually last at some point coming around the far turn. And then when they got into the stretch, she asked her again, and she was passing horses after the wire. I think she actually finished fourth in this race. Maybe if she was fifth, I forget. But she just ran a weird race, and she's a horse that did run well at her last victory at Saratoga, and maybe this was a tough spot for her, but I think she's better than her performance here.
I think it comes down to trip handicapping as well. When you see a note like that, or a ride where they can be, you know, second, third, or in the pocket, and they end up dead last, you know, maybe focus on that. Could it have been a rider thing? And then if you see a rider change next time out, well, then, yeah, it probably was the rider doing it, and maybe not under instruction. And then you can make that positive on whoever ends up in the irons next time out.
Yeah, one other horse that maybe people will key in on as a horse to give another chance out of this race is Making Sense, because if you were watching the race live, you would have noticed she broke through the starting gate twice before the race. And that's something I don't think I've ever seen before. A horse breaking through once is quite common, but doing it two times in a row is very rare. That said, it didn't seem like it unsettled her at all. It looked like she was almost just playing around a little bit, and the other horses all had to stand in the gate while she was having her fun. And she still ran the race that you would have expected out of her, even if you liked her in here. She ran, I think, one of her better races. So I don't think I'd upgrade this performance for her, even though she was acting up before the start, because I didn't see it take a lot out of her. And I think with situations like that, you have to look at how the horse reacted to those antics before a race to determine if you want to upgrade or downgrade the horse's performance based on that.
Let's jump into our last race of this pod, race number 9, another state bred 125,000. It was the Iroquois going 6.5 on the dirt. Obviously a horse like Newly Minted was interesting for me. I just thought, and I can't remember the horse, the West Coast horse, but just coming out off of a layoff, wins a race, but just the buyer deteriorating so bad, almost 10 points. Just kind of seems like it's not the same horse, and I knew this horse was going to take money, so I was trying to look elsewhere. What about you, David?
So Newly Minted is kind of a funny horse, and this was a weird race because she is clearly the most accomplished filly in this, four-year-old filly in this field. But there were a lot of horses that were kind of on the cusp of being contenders if this favorite didn't show up. And you basically had to say to yourself, well, what's the chances that Newly Minted doesn't show up? And based on the last race, you could say, well, the chances are pretty good because she had everything in her favor in that Union Avenue. Radikowski, her main rival, didn't break, basically handing her an easy victory. But she still had to work pretty hard to get it done over some horses that you might have thought were inferior. We talked about how Forever Change was a little overmatched in the Empire Distaff while she was right there at the end of this race, losing by less than a length. And Newly Minted, in my opinion, watching that race, she was supposed to win that Union Avenue by 2 or 3 lengths based on how the race transpired, and she just barely got it done. And then you put that in the context of Newly Minted's entire career, where she came out guns blazing as a three-year-old, back in April of 2019, running an 81 buyer speed figure in her first start. And after that, she just never really got any better. And she didn't have to because she was fast enough right from the start to win a bunch of stakes races mm-hmm. and be competitive against some older horses coming into the fall of that year. But she came back this year and you could say to yourself, well, okay, still she hasn't gotten any faster. And maybe she's even regressed a little bit from being so precocious early on. So there were some reasons to be skeptical of this favorite.
I think that's another good angle that people don't talk about as much as, you know, Mohame and horses like that were so precocious at 2, and these horses that win 4 straight races and then finally, you know, middle of the Triple Crown trail, the other 3-year-olds kind of catch up, and then they're 4 to 5, but they're losing because these horses are making 5-10 point jumps and they're only making the 2 or 3 point jumps at that point.
Yeah, exactly. And also, she had drawn the rail in this race and she was turning back in distance, so you had to say to yourself, well, okay, she also had the rail in the Empire Distaff last year, and she broke okay that day, but she had to rate inside of horses and didn't put forth her best performance in that race. So then you're saying to yourself, okay, well, if there are other faster horses in this race, which there appeared to be, how is she going to react to rating inside behind horses going a sprint distance? It's a little bit of an unknown for her. So that was another thing to be concerned about with a horse that was going to be a short price.
Another question I wanted to ask you, Rob Atteris did have 2 horses in this race. What are your thoughts with trainers with multiple entries in each race? Is it kind of just like you hear so much, oh, it's the other Chad that won. Oh, the other Todd won down at Gulfstream. Like, I just don't seem to understand why people just kind of make that move. Like, oh, obviously they were in cahoots or something, when it's obviously Michael Dubb and then a different ownership for the other horse. They're both trying to win.
Exactly. Especially in a stakes race like this, this is the logical spot for both of these horses to run in. It's not like Rob Atteris said, okay, well, I've got these 2 contenders who can both win, but I'm going to decide that one of them can win and the other can't. So the other horse is going to be the sacrificial lamb to help this horse, even though maybe the horse that I'm making the sacrificial lamb is the one that's more likely to win the race. That's not what goes through trainers' heads. They're just going to say to the riders, look, ride your own race and see what happens, play the break, and both try to win. And both of these horses were contenders. I mean, I probably preferred Fair Regis a little bit, but it was close between these 2 horses. The one situation where I think you could say that maybe a trainer is trying to make sure both of his horses get decent trips is a situation where a trainer has two horses in the same race and they're both speed types, then maybe you say to yourself, okay, is he instructing one rider to be more aggressive than the other one? And we do see that sometimes. So I think it's okay to think about it in that situation, because if you've got a horse and one of your two entrants needs the lead, maybe you're going to instruct the other horse with speed to, okay, if that horse goes, maybe you just sit second. And I'm sure that happens quite a bit, but that was not the situation this Iroquois.
I did like Officer Hutchie, actually, off that last race. First off, the claim for Atrus, just jumping up from a 25 non-winners of three lifetime into the stake and getting the job done as the favorite. I just kind of thought that it was a small decline, but maybe that being in the Atrus barn second time out, it might be a little bit more time for improvement. Prairie Fire, this type of horse had showed speed, and then it actually ended up running second in an N1X open company allowance, and I tend to like those type of horses that can do well in the open company, and then even though it is a state bred stake race, I still kind of feel like those kind of races speed figure wise kind of end up being right around the same.
Yeah, I thought that Prairie Fire made some sense in this race coming in off those two speed figures that were so improved. That put her right on the same plane as Newly Minted, who had, even at her best, was running speed figures like that last year against Stakes Company. I was a little concerned about the pace of this race. I wasn't sure if Newly Minted was going to be able to show speed from the inside. And there is some speed on the outside. You've got Spin a Yarn, who looked like she had to go. You had Bertrand to her outside, who sometimes does show quite a bit of speed, other times not. So I wasn't sure how the pace was going to play out. And I thought it was likely to be a moderate pace. And I was a little reticent to pick a big closer in this race if the pace didn't really heat up the way that I would think it would need to for a horse to come from way back. And with Prairie Fire, well, she had the deep closer in the past. As you said, she had shown better tactical speed in some recent races, so maybe you could say that she might be a horse that could get a little more in the game early. She was one of the horses that I left open in this race. Honestly, when I was handicapping, I said, okay, I could pick Newly Minted, I could pick Fair Regis, though I kind of downgraded her because she's not really a winning type. And I left open Espresso Shot, I left open Prairie Fire, I left open Collegeville Girl, and I left open Timely Tradition. And then I just kind of had to sort them out to see who I thought was most likely, who was going to be the best value. And I landed on Timely Tradition, just thinking that maybe she would pull the right trip, stalking outside of that moderate pace that I was expecting. And she's just been a wind machine lately. She had the speed figure power. So I just thought that she would be the horse that was the most likely winner, that would not be the favorite. So I landed on her.
As I had said, I actually ended up on Prairie Fire. Just a win play show across the board for me. You ended up on Timely Tradition. Let's see who can win the ninth race here at Belmont right now.
Bertranda goes out for the lead. Spin a Yarn runs in second. Timely Tradition is next in third. My Roxy Girl on the extreme outside in fourth. Officer Hutchie down at the rail in fifth, with Fair Regis alongside in sixth. Then Espresso Shot in seventh. Newly Minted now moving up down from the rail in eighth. It's four lengths back to Prairie Fire in ninth. And Collegeville Girl is the early trailer in 10th, the quarter 22 and 2. It is Spin a Yarn and Bertranda, and they are heads apart for the lead. Timely Tradition is 3 wide, and My Roxy Girl is 4 wide. Down towards the rail is Officer Hutchie, who is racing in 5th. Fair Regis and Espresso Shot, they are together. Newly Minted is at the rail, and about 4 lengths from the lead. And then it is Prairie Fire and Collegeville Girl. The half went in 45 and 2/5 seconds. The field comes into the stretch. Spin a Yarn, Timely Tradition, Bertranda in between those two. Timely Tradition has now come away with the lead. Officer Hutchie, and gaining ground late here is Prairie Fire. It is Timely Tradition with the lead. Prairie Fire, here's Collegeville Girl, who was last making a run on the extreme outside. Here comes Collegeville Girl. Here comes Prairie Fire. Collegeville Girl got it.
And the number 6, Collegeville Girl, gets it done. 48-20 was the winning mutual with an 86 buyer. I mean, at the top of this is a great trip handicapping kind of race where when you see 6 horses up at the front and there's 2 way at the back, you can be quite sure that the pace is probably fast.
Yeah, and coming around the far turn, I felt like I'd gotten part of this race right, because you could tell right from the start, okay, Newly Minted's probably not running today because she broke very slowly. I think she was actually last away from the gate, She was out of position heading into the far turn. She's not the kind of horse that you would say, okay, she's seventh early on the rail, buried in traffic. She's not the kind of horse that you would expect to overcome that kind of trip. So I thought, okay, Newly Minted's out of this. And now we've got a couple horses on the lead, Spin It Yarn and Bertranda. And Timely Tradition is three wide stalking outside of them. So I said, okay, I at least got this part of the race right because my horse is getting the right trip. But as you said, they were going a little bit faster than I would have liked up front. And you had those two horses way at the back of the pack, and they came into the stretch, and Timely Tradition took over from those two other speeds. And it looked like she might be home free at the eighth pole, but she had these two horses running at her with a full head of steam, and they both got by her at the wire. So this was a frustrating loss for me, especially because I did give a long look to both Prairie Fire and Collegeville Girl. Prairie Fire was the more logical of the two. And Collegeville Girl, I ended up leaving her out of my top four completely. I did use her in the exacta with Timely Tradition because, as I said, this race was so wide open and I wanted to use a lot of horses aside from Newly Minted with my top pick. And Collegeville Girl, while she was a little light on speed figures, she is a horse that I thought was going to really benefit from the rider switch to Joel Rosario, because not to knock her prior regular rider, Castillo, who's been on her quite a bit out of town, but he would often get her buried inside or get her in a little bit of trouble and not always get the maximum effort out of her closing kick. And Joel Rosario is just the kind of rider that fits horses like this so well. So I was anticipating her to run a better race than she had in her previous starts. I just didn't realize that she could run this much better.
I think that's the hard thing. This kind of speed figure improvement from a 73 to an 86 reminds me of She Shares the Devil in the Kentucky Oaks, where you have three or four decent horses. And then she's kind of like the fifth outside horse, and she ends up improving while everyone else remains stagnant. I could see this horse if there was another 80 buyer somewhere in her sheet. Unfortunately, it was this race that it ends up being. But the only 80 she had was off a soft trip in a N1X State Bred Allowance, where she won by 9 with Blue Fractions. I mean, I instantly just downgraded that race to right being in, you know, a high 70 to mid 70. So she had never even cracked the 80 buyer before. Now she just, I think, got the right setup. I couldn't believe Cancel making the moves down the inside mid-pack. And then I just saw Joel and I said, well, no one outfaces Joel and I'm going to lose right at the wire. And it just ended up happening like that. But that's, again, that's why you put Joel on a horse like this, because he just can power those horses home in the sprints from a closing position, which not many jockeys, I think, do a good job of.
Yeah, it's funny. That's a race that you mentioned, her nine-length victory at Aqueduct last year when she had gotten that 82 buyer speed figure. That's a race just based on, trip handicapping and pace dynamics. You do want to downgrade naturally because she was on top of a slow pace, and she finished off the race and won easily, and the other horses that were way behind that pace were compromised. However, if you go back and watch that race and you watch a lot of the races around it at Aqueduct at the time of year, you just did not see horses coming home their last day in 12 seconds. I mean, she finished that race off like a freight train. And yes, she got a perfect trip to do it, but you could look back at that race and say, okay, when things really work out well for her, she's got some monster late kick on her. It's just she doesn't always produce it, and she doesn't always get ridden in a way to produce it. So you had to really hope that everything would go perfectly for her to produce that kind of late kick again. And she had the right rider on to make it happen. And that's what did happen.
And I think, too, just to get into a little bit of wagering conversation here, you know, everyone, oh, this horse, you know, $48. How can you find this horse? Everyone else, like we had said, the race pretty much was wide open. And if you don't like a favorite, I think that's the type of race where if you're normally going, you know, two or three deep with a vulnerable favorite, I thought this favorite was just very false and I was looking to play against completely. That's when you can start going four or five deep. And now you kind of have to open up your mind and be like, okay, I'm going to try and go a little bit deeper here because I think the race is so wide open. The race two back, she lost by a length to Newly Minted. I mean, I know the buyer figure wasn't there, but if a horse has run that close to a horse that's going to be or the favorite at this level, I think it's kind of a spot where you need to be more open and just try to figure out how you can get that extra value.
Yeah, in a race like this, I think there's one of two ways you can go from a wagering standpoint, at least as it pertains to intra-race wagers. You could say, okay, this field is so wide open, and I like one horse quite a bit. I'm going to key on that one horse and try to use her with a lot of other horses that could create value in my exotics wagers. And just, you know, make a nice win bet on that one horse that you really like. And for me, that was Timely Tradition. Or you could say, okay, I don't really trust anybody in this race. I just know that I want to bet against the favorite. So I'm going to just kind of look through, see who's the best value, and maybe box up those horses or use them together in exotics wagers. And maybe Prairie Fire and Collegeville Girl were two of those horses for you. That's the way that you get to a winning wager on a race like this.
That is all the time we have for today. I want to thank my special guest, David Aragona, for coming on. David, where can people find you on social media?
You can follow me on Twitter at Horse2Watch. You can get my Naira analysis for every racing day at the Naira tracks at naira.com/timeformus. I also do plenty for DRF.com. So any of those places, you can get some of what I'm putting out there.
You also have a great podcast with Craig Molkowski, too. I'll let you leave a little plug-in for that as well.
Yeah, twice a week, usually, when our schedules allow. Craig makes the Timeform US speed figures. We do two Timeform US podcasts, one early in the week, looking back on the prior weekend's races to recap them, a lot of the stakes racing, talk about divisional standings, things like that. And then we'll do another podcast later in the week, typically on Fridays, where we handicap some of the upcoming weekend's races. So you can get those on all the places where you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Google, SoundCloud, any of those. Those are the Timeform US Pacecast and the Timeform US Forecast.
Thank you so much for coming on, David. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to all the listeners for tuning into this program and my special guest, David Aragona. This show is a production of In the Money Media. In the Money Media's president is Pierre Thomas Fornatel. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin, and our In the Money Media business manager is Drew Coatney. I'm Spencer Lugenbuehl, and we will see you next time.